The St. Augustine Institute of Catholic Studies presents Brother Francis with his regular Tuesday night lecture. This is Tuesday, May 13th, 1986. Brother Francis.
And of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, amen. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary,
Our Lady, Seat of Wisdom.
Praise.
Our Lady, Queen of Martyrs.
Praise.
Our Lady of the Blessed Eucharist.
Praise.
Our Lady of Fatima.
Praise.
St. Robert Bellarmine.
Praise.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Amen. We are entering a whole new phase in philosophy tonight. I think the first talk I gave you, I said that the Greeks, to whom we owe this whole discipline, I think if the Greeks had never existed, we would never have philosophy, there would be other things. Said that philosophy has three parts, and they call them logic, physics, and ethics. Very nice Greek words. Logic, the study of thought. Physics, the study of nature, phusis means nature. Ethics, the study of behavior, human behavior. They correspond to the three simple English words, to know, to be, and to do. We have had courses of logic, the very first one we had. We had two courses that could be called physics, cosmology and psychology, the study of nature, and then the study of human nature, a nature that means a great deal to us. And now we come to the third type of philosophy, the study of ethics. I also told you once, I think, that the philosophers speak of the speculative intellect and the practical intellect. And that they do not mean that we have two intellects. It's the same faculty, the same spiritual power for knowing in us, but it has these two different uses. Speculative, when it just looks to see what is, it doesn't make it. Practical, when it has something to do with making it. And so ethics involves the practical intellect. We are dealing now with the things that depend on us men. I am going to read you two short passages tonight by way of introduction. And the first is, I am going to read two paragraphs from Aristotle, the very opening of his book, on ethics. It is called the Nicomachean Ethics because he had a son, Nicomachus, and he dedicated this work to him. So when he was talking about establishing the norms of noble, virtuous behavior, it was very fitting that he should direct it to his son. As far as I know, he never dedicated any other work of his, and he has hundreds of works, to anybody. But that's one book that he did dedicate to his son, Nicomachus. And as we read him, I would want you to keep in mind another important distinction. We are going to be introducing the fundamental concepts that will be needed for this new discipline we are learning. Ethics, as we study it, we can be studied on two planes, the natural and the supernatural. And this is very simply the relation between them. Whenever the natural is what we can discover by our intelligence apart from any revelation from God. The supernatural are the things that we start to conclude having been given God's revelations. There is nothing that the mind discovers when it is correctly functioning that would be wrong. In other words, natural philosophy, and that would also include the philosophy of ethics, is correct as far as it goes, but it will have its deficiencies. The natural mind can go wrong, but when it is correct, there's nothing it does that would contradict what will have to be added when we finally have God's revelations. Now, in this course, I am not going to divide it into two parts, natural ethics for several weeks and then supernatural. St. Thomas doesn't do that. The Summa does not distinguish between what belongs to the natural order and what belongs to the order of grace. They are all together. We distinguish, we do not divide. So we can tell what truths could have been known by the mind unaided any further. All our actions have to be somehow aided by God's concurrence, but that's not what we mean by grace. So very soon we are going to be studying the relation between nature and grace. We are not beginning to do that yet. But when Aristotle is talking, well, that is the natural mind doing its best. So let us see how far he goes and what are some of the concepts that are going to be very valuable for us when we proceed further in the course. I would like to make a little reservation now. I think that the people who distinguish too much when it comes to concrete realities, to men, and they say Aristotle obviously had absolutely nothing to do with the supernatural because he was a pagan, I don't agree with that. The supernatural revelations were given to Adam, and there is no man and no culture that does not descend from Adam. So there is no such thing as a civilization that was sheerly natural. It's a matter of emphasis rather than of a clear, absolute distinction. But at least Aristotle was consciously trying to think with his reason, and he was not at the time expounding any revelation, whether coming from Adam or from anybody else. So the distinction stays there, but I like to have made that reservation even at this depth. There is no such thing as a civilization that has never been exposed to the supernatural. That's a very important principle, very important fact. Nobody can disagree with it when you state it, but it is astounding how little is it mentioned, even in Catholic seminaries, in Catholic colleges. Now let us begin with Aristotle now. Every art and every science and every practical pursuit seem to aim at some good. He gives us a trinity there. When I gave you that first trinity, logic, physics, ethics, I could put them in the order physics, logic, ethics. There is a little reflection of the trinity there. In physics, we study what God the Father made, and our part is purely speculative. We have nothing to do with it. In logic, we study how reality can be deceived by a mind, by thought. And so we do it in honor of God the Son, who is the thought of the Eternal Father, the Logos. And in ethics, we do it in honor of God the Holy Ghost, and because he is the love by which our actions should be guided. There is here another trinity. The three things all civilization can be summarized. And when we come later to the particulars, I will give you a chart that summarizes all civilization into three types of activity. And we can call them Scientia, Ars, and Moralitas. Science, art, and morality. Science, what we know, you can study now, look at what we call civilization. Anything that has to do with philosophy, knowledge, education, science, scientia. Ars, the concept of art in philosophy, and I would like you to get used to it now, is not as restricted as it is in the English language. When you say she is an artist, you mean she draws pictures, and that's all we think of. Ars in philosophy means the making of anything. There is an art to every human activity, just as there is a scientific aspect to it, just as there is a moral aspect, which is the aspect we study here. So that's another trinity. I'm not going to stop to meditate now on how to relate that trinity to the Holy Trinity either, but there it is. The definitions that I will have you learn them by heart, they say, scientia stricta ratio cognoscibilium, moralitas et recta ratio agibilium, and ars is recta ratio factibilium, the right application of reason to the things we know, that's science, the right application of reason to the things we make, that's art, the right application of reason to the things we do, that's morality. My father used to give us lectures on the distinction between make and do. And I remember the cynics, and we could see that when you have cynicism like that, you don't go the whole way. They drop somewhere on the way. They say, oh, father is going to be talking against make and do again. You know, so just get tired, sick of it. That's a tremendous distinction. It's in fundamentals like that that all our values eventually reside and are protected. So Aristotle is saying that in all human activities seem to aim at some good. You say, isn't that very simple? Childlike, yes, but how easily is it forgotten? Everything that man does is aiming at what seems to be a good. Hence, it has been well said that the good is that at which all things aim. It is true that a certain variety is to be observed among the ends at which the arts and sciences aim. In some cases, the activity of practicing the art is itself the end, whereas in others, the end is some product over and above the mere exercise of art. Now, again, in the arts, you can see this, a sculptor. When he finishes, there is a statue. But a singer, when he finishes, there's nothing left. Now, the sculpture teaches us, emphasizes the aspect of make. It's obviously a fact of something being made, a statue. The singer emphasizes the do. The performance itself is what's aiming at. The good there is in the performance itself. But having been given something to help our intelligence to make the distinction, there is a do involved in the sculpture, and there is a make involved in the singing. The performance is something. It's not something as material as a statue, but once your mind discovers that distinction, it is an object to be aimed at perfecting. Then he says, there are numerous pursuits and arts and sciences. It follows that their ends are correspondingly numerous. For instance, the end of the science of medicine is health. that of the art of shipbuilding, a vessel, a ship, unless you have victory, that of domestic economy, wealth. You see now what you mean by saying every activity aims at some good. What are the goods we talked about there? Health, making ships, victory in war, wealth in economy. When you study economy, what's the good at which human activity is directed? Wealth, achieving wealth. Now, in cases where several such pursuits are subordinate to some single power, as bridle making and the other trades concerned with horses' harness, are subordinate to horsemanship, and this and every other military pursuit to the science of strategy. What is he establishing here? A hierarchy of ends. Now, I am not a specialist in horses. There are people here who are, but I won't make a fool of myself talking about that. But let's take one case where we all understand it. Pharmacy. There are many sciences involved with pharmacy. And medicine. Do you see what I mean by a subordination? The sciences and the arts of pharmacy are subordinate to the sciences and arts of medicine. See that? So there are subordinations. The concept of means and ends. We take medicine to become healthy. You don't say, isn't that wonderful? He is so healthy he can consume many medicines. You know, we don't use health for medicine, we use medicines for health. The distinction is between means and ends. Something could be an end up to a point and then becomes a means for something else. But then Aristotle tells us that cannot go on ad infinitum. Now that is one of the first principles of good thinking. The sophists of today would like to discredit it. It is impossible to seek everything for something else. Do you see that? I want medicine. Why? Because I want to be healthy. Why do you want to be healthy? Because something else. Why do you want that something else for something else? So everything is desired only as means. It cannot be. If there are things that are desired as means, there has to be something that's desired as an end. Do you see what we are aiming at? We are heading at establishing the ultimate end. Now, this is one of the greatest paragraphs that I'm going to begin now that Aristotle ever wrote. And there's nothing we disagree with. The supernatural does not have to correct anything in it. He says, if therefore among the ends at which our actions aim, there be one which we wish for its own sake, while we wish the others only for the sake of this, and if we do not choose everything for the sake of something else, which would obviously result in a process ad infinitum, so that all desire would be futile and vain. It is clear that this one ultimate end must be the good, and indeed the supreme good. Now, that's the most important concept in this course of ethics that's going to be with us throughout the course. What is it in Latin? The summum bonum. If there is no ultimate good, then everything is a means. And if everything is a means, even the very concept of means seems to be meaningful. If everything is desired for something else, and nothing for its own sake, but that's the end of all value. Do you see that? So here Aristotle, a philosopher, no, he did not say because Isaiah said, because God revealed, because, you know, just using his own mind, the natural light of reason, comes out with this tremendously important concept. Is there a supreme good? And if there is a supreme good, is it something objective? Now, we have been trying to defend objectivity in logic. We have been trying to defend it in physics. But the most important place to defend objectivity in philosophy is in ethics. And that's going to lead me to the next thing I'm going to read after I finish Aristotle. I only have a few more lines. Will not then a knowledge of this supreme good be also of great practical importance for the conduct of life? Will it not better enable us to attain what is fitting, like archers having a target to aim at? Every human act is like an arrow that an archer is throwing. Isn't that something to think about? And if you don't have an aim, I remember one day we had that very big wall. We surrounded our community in Cambridge so that the children won't be exposed to the language of the street and so on. And one of the brothers took a snowball and threw it. And then he said, "Let me see you hit that board." Well, of course, he hit whatever board. I mean, it had to hit some board. So he made it look like, let me see you hit that board, you know. Now, if there is no aim, there is no objective principle by which people can discuss value. You see how all these things depend on each other. Now, we live in an age in which the very concept of an objective standard has completely disappeared. Will not then a knowledge of the supreme good be also of great practical importance for the conduct of life? Will it not better enable us to attain what is fitting, like archers having a target to aim at? Now, with the conviction that we are going to live forever, and with the conviction that we have only one life to live, now we see some of these occult religions and philosophies moving in on us and undermining all of these fundamentals. Notice the preciousness of every act, the preciousness of every moment. Everything we do is an opportunity that once lost, is lost forever. It will never come again. You will have another day and you could do probably other things, but what was to be done on May 13th, Tuesday, May 13th, was not done. You missed it. It's an opportunity God gave you and it was wasted. You see the preciousness. Every act, if we live forever, every act we perform casts a long, long shadow. Now, all these realizations that made the saints can be undermined. Undermine the foundations of them, and they go. Undermine the belief in immortality, all of this disappears. It's absolutely impossible for a person who believes the fundamental truths of our faith, the truths that we proclaim when we say the creed, and one who does not believe them, it's utterly impossible that they should have the same objective norms, ideals of goodness, of virtue, of nobility. Impossible. If this be so, we ought to make an attempt to determine at all events and outline what exactly this summum bonum, this supreme good, is, and of which of the theoretical or practical sciences is it the object. That's one paragraph from Aristotle. It's a very fitting, very good introduction to our course. The other thing I meant to read tonight with you, and then I will open the question period, which I am coming to like very much. I am reading you a few, one or two pages from Gilbert Keith Chesterton. I'm not going to take the time to read them with you here. There's so much for us to do, and this is something you can do by yourself. But by choosing one paragraph and doing it with you, at least it will help you to read the rest. It's taken from a book that was written by Chesterton about 8 years after he had come into the faith. He wrote Orthodoxy, I think, 12 years before he was a Catholic, which is really a fantastic paradox. He was famous for his paradoxes. I think that's the greatest paradox of his whole life. But this was written after he became a Catholic. He gave it the title, The Thing. I'm not going to elaborate on that. I think this was suggested by Belloc. Belloc used to like to use the word thing in its deep Latin significance. Res, reality, the thing. But the subtitle is, Why I Am a Catholic. So it's almost his explaining, his apologia for having come to the faith. He's answering an American writer, H.L. Mencken. Father used to talk about him an awful lot. He was the editor of the American Mercury. A very forceful writer. When he was making these statements, he was shocking people, but he and a few like him have created a whole generation that think that same way. So he's a powerful and effective writer. And Mr. Chesterton is answering him. Now let me read first a quotation that Chesterton gives from H.L. Mencken, and then how he answers it. Now, why am I doing this on the first night of a course in ethics? I am trying to tell you what is the mass of mentality out in the whole country that we are going to face with our ethical course. What do we mean when we speak of this subjectivism, this elimination of all norms? So, Chesterton will do it much better than I can, so just let me read now. Two other characteristic passages from Mr. Mencken will show more sharply the curious sense in which he misses his own point. On the one hand, he appears to state most positively the purely personal and subjective nature of criticism. He makes it individual and almost irresponsible. Individual, that means subjective. Quote, this is a quote now from H.L. Mencken. The critic is first and last simply trying to express himself. Have you ever heard that? Express himself, you know, just. Now, you know, criticism must imply norms, right? Unless you have norms, you don't try to find what is wrong. So he was a critic, and yet he was undermining the very principles of criticism. So the critic is first and last simply trying to express himself. He is trying to achieve thereby for his own inner ego the grateful feeling of a function performed, a tension relieved, a catharsis attained, which Wagner achieved when he wrote Die Walküre, and a hen achieves every time she lays an egg. End quote. Now Chesterton goes back to talk. That's all consistent enough as far as it goes, but unfortunately, Mr. Mencken appears to go on to something quite inconsistent with it. According to the quotation, he afterwards bursts into a song of triumph because there is now in America not only criticism but controversy. He was for controversy, so am I. We were famous for not being shy of controversy. All right, today, for the first time in years, there is strife in American criticism. Ears are bitten off, noses are bloodied. There are wallops both above and below the belt, end quote. Now Chesterton again. Now there may be something in his case for controversy, but it's quite inconsistent with his case for creative self-expression. If the critic produces the criticism only to please himself, it's entirely irrelevant that it does not please somebody else. The somebody else has a perfect right to say the exact opposite to please himself and to be perfectly satisfied with himself. But they cannot controvert because they cannot compare. They cannot compare because there is no common standard of comparison. Neither I nor anybody else can have a controversy about literature with Mr. Mencken, because there is no way of criticizing the criticism, except by asking whether the critic is satisfied. And there the debate ends at the beginning. For nobody can doubt that Mr. Mencken is satisfied. But not to make Mr. Mencken a mere victim of the argumentum ad hominem, I will make the experiment in a viler body and offer myself for dissection. I dare say a great deal of the criticism I write really is removed by a mood of self-expression. I can take something or other about which I have definite feelings. As, for instance, the philosophy of Mr. Dreiser, the novelist, which has been mentioned more than once in this debate. I can achieve for my own inner ego the grateful feeling of writing as follows. And here Chesterton is quoting himself. That's what I would say about Mr. Dreiser. He describes a world which appears to be a dull and discoloring illusion of indigestion, not bright enough to be called a nightmare, smelly but not even stinking with any strength, smelling of the stale gas of ignorant chemical experiment by dirty, secretive schoolboys, the sort of boys who torture cats in corners, spineless and spiritless like a broken-backed worm, loathsomely slow and laborious like an endless slug, despairing but not with dignity, blaspheming but not with courage, without wit, without will, without laughter or uplifting of the heart, too old to die, too deaf to leave off talking, too blind to stop, too stupid to start afresh, too dead to be killed, and incapable even of being damned, since in all its weary centuries it has not reached the age of reason. End quote. This Chesterton and quotes himself. That's what I feel about it, and it certainly gives me pleasure to relieve my feelings. I have got it off my chest, I have attained a catharsis, I have laid an egg, I have produced a criticism satisfying all Mr. Mencken's definition of the critic. I have performed a function. I feel better, thank you. But what influence my feelings can be expected to have on Mr. Dreiser or anybody who does not admit my standards of truth and falsehood, I do not quite see. Mr. Dreiser can hardly be expected to say that his chemistry is quackery, as I think it, quackery without the liveliness we might reasonably expect from quacks. He does not think fatalism base and servile, as I do. He does not think free will the highest truth about humanity, as I do. He does not believe that despair is itself a sin, and perhaps the worst of sins, as Catholics do. He does not think blasphemy the smallest and silliest sort of pride, as even pagans do. He naturally does not think his own picture of life is false picture, resembling real life about as much as a wilderness of linoleum would resemble the land of all the living flowers, as I do. But he would not think it falser for being like a wilderness. He would probably admit that it was dreary, but think it correct to be dreary. He would probably own that he was hopeless, but not see any harm in being hopeless. What I advance as accusations, he would very probably accept as compliments. So, I say I've chosen those two chapters not as an integral part of my ethics course, but as a stimulant to to let you know how important it is that a course like that should be part of our apostolate. I will end the lecture part for tonight at this, and after a few... Yes?
A friend of mine who's a captain in the Army made a comment once, and I think the more I listen to your summation of the current age and Mencken's remarks, the more I can see the wisdom in the remark. He made a statement, he said, everything is mind over matter. If you don't mind, it don't matter.
Very good.
Too simple.
Very good. Yes?
Brother, in Orthodoxy, Chesterton discusses whether morality came first or law, or commandments. And he says that morality had to come first. Because, and it tracks to what Aristotle was saying, that's the supreme good in the Genesis for establishing norms. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, before the Ten Commandments were given by God, every man knew that he shouldn't blaspheme, that he should love his creator, that he shouldn't kill, he shouldn't commit impurity. That's why the foundations of morality are the correct understanding of reality. In one of my courses, my students will still remember it, I think, I said, a mother could give the command to a child in two ways. She could say, don't drop this basket you are holding. Supposing he's holding, give them a basket to hold. Don't drop it. Don't hit it against something hard. Don't. These are commands. These are laws. But she can also tell them, it has eggs. The one statement about reality, if they have intelligence, they can reason the commandments. That's why once you understand what man is, when you truly believe that every human being is a person who is going to live forever, it's absolutely impossible to behave with regard to that person, and that would include yourself and myself, the way you did before you knew that fact. And since the human mind is capable of arriving at a knowledge of immortality, and since the whole human tradition seems to have had it revealed to them right from the start, I mean, this is one of the truths that is both revealed and can be arrived at with sound thinking. And it's only when you start deliberately confusing your thinking that you can cloud these truths. These boys and girls in the country today that are behaving like animals, they have not been using their minds correctly to know what they are. The science of ethics presupposes the correct understanding of the real. Reality is when you know that there is God, there are angels, the spiritual reality, there's immortality. These are the realities. Once you know these things, the moral order proceeds from them.
You have divided the powers of the intellect as being, or is it of the soul, as being knowing and doing?
Well, knowing, willing,
yeah.
Doing.
Yeah. But not all doing is ethical, is it?
Not all doing is ethical.
There are many things that we do that don't have an ethical dimension to it. Isn't that right?
Let's say if you build
a bridge or something, or if you build a house.
Well,
these things in themselves are not good or bad.
Well, it is a good.
Well, they see. Yeah.
It has the goodness of means.
Yeah.
Yes.
There are three kinds of goodness: the bonum utile, the bonum honestum, and the bonum delectabile. And the bonum delectabile has the aspect of finality in it right away. The bonum honestum is both, has the finality and means. The bonum utile has the goodness of means. but it has a goodness. The human act, that was another thing that I would have introduced tonight, but I didn't want to introduce too many ideas. The first thing we have to learn in the course in ethics is to distinguish between what the philosophers call the actus hominis and the actus humanus. The actus hominis, an act of man and a human act. Now, what is the distinction? An act of man. As I'm talking to you now, my hair is growing. Is that something that my human nature is doing? Yes. Is it a human act? No. It's the same thing that plants are doing, you see? As I'm talking to you, my blood is circulating. My human nature is doing that. My food is being digested, you know? These are actus, in the plural, hominis, of a man. They are acts of a man, of a human nature. But they are not human acts. The act itself does not reflect the definition, the essence of man. It doesn't reflect the rationality. When the act is an actus humanus, when the act reflects the full reality of what man is, well, it has to be directed at a good. It can't be just... You say, well, he's taking a walk and he's isn't doing any harm, he's killing anybody. Well, exercise is good, you know. I mean, there is a goodness to it. Something made him decide to go out and... Every one of you is in this room tonight by an actus humanus, a human act. It was the most deliberate thing you did today. There could be thousands of things you could be doing, thousands, an infinity of places you could be in. But you have chosen to be here because, for some reason, you think that it's good to be here. That's an actus humanus. Once it is an actus humanus, it is directed to some end. And if it's directed to some end, it directs you to something that has the aspect of goodness.
Now, let's say you build a bridge that doesn't hold up, doesn't hold the traffic, let's say.
Very good. Now, that's where every art has a certain autonomy. You don't say, well, he meant well, but the bridge collapsed. I mean, the man could be very pious and very moral, but he is not a good bridge builder. Every art has a certain autonomy and has a certain end that determines its effectiveness. And that could be fully recognized without in any way denying the hierarchy of ends.
Pope St. Scholar is going to be a good example of that.
Yeah, very good. A great saint in the papacy, but practically ruined the church. Because he had the moral aspect, but he did not have the art of being Pope. Now, the very important thing to distinguish without dividing. Now, some disciplines divide these things to help our intelligence. In some cases, you could see clearly the moral aspect. The priest is giving a sermon. Obviously, the main thing there is the moral. But still, there is an art. He could have the best of intentions, but not carry it over, you see, not reach the people. There's an art to it, too. So the art of it and the moral aspect of it are not the same thing. And the science of it is also another distinct aspect. Every single thing, you can distinguish those three aspects to them. We are interested in this course primarily with the moral aspect. But we are not denying or even dividing from the others. Yes?
Is it too much of a simplification to say that the acts of a man are the acts of man, as you said, actus hominis?
Actus hominis, yeah.
Do not involve the will, and human acts do involve the will.
Yes, that's exactly.
It's will that's involved.
Yeah.
When you're talking about means, I was thinking of as the ultimate natural good, we all desire to live forever, right?
Yeah.
But we're not thinking of that when we eat as the means to live.
Yeah, now even the natural...
Think of life when we
eat. Yeah, well, if you notice, Aristotle didn't say all deliberate acts aim at some end. He said all processes, all activity even in nature. Even the wind blowing, and St. Thomas develops that very fully and strongly. Every act, all nature, that comes out very beautifully in the Divine Comedy, you know, the whole world is somehow aiming at the goodness of God. But that's, we are anticipating, we're running ahead of ourselves tonight. But that's exactly what it is. When the will, and then the will has to follow the intellect, are involved, well then the whole human rational nature is involved, and the act reflects not only one aspect of man. Seeing that man somehow summarizes all reality, if you drop a man from a window, he will be falling. You say, it's a man falling, but he is falling like a stone. See, the act, he's falling like a mineral. He's not falling like a human being. Because there's nothing he can do about it. It's the law of gravity that governs all material things. As I'm talking now, I'm pressing on the floor. That's the man pressing on the floor. But it could have been a bag of potatoes to be doing the same thing. So that's the first distinction to make. And when it is an actus humanus, then it is responsible, then it is directed. Then, and it's only when we start thinking in these terms that we see how everything we do is like an arrow. It should be aiming at some good. It's aiming at some apparent good, but is it aiming at the real good? And that's the whole problem of ethics.
Would Immanuel Kant say something like, people are aiming at what they perceive as good, or would that be accurate?
Well, Immanuel Kant, you see, we will come to him. I am saving the polemic part of this of the whole course until we have finished the first four courses and established positions. At the end of this course now, the first, we have eight courses we are going to take together, and I hope I will be living to finish them. Four courses. And the first four of them have a kind of are a bundle all by themselves. At the end of them, we will have positions clearly stated. Then we proceed to study people like Immanuel Kant and see where did he leave off and what did he lead to. What effect his kind of thinking has produced in the world. Now, it's not only in morality. I mean, what Kant has done before he even comes to morality, he had already swallowed the whole time and space of his subjective perceptibility. We will come to that, but it's a little too early to introduce Kant. Everything becomes subjective. And that is the bane of the age today, subjectivism. It's coming out so beautifully and so clearly in those videotapes that Father gave us. And I think we should all see them together. I have seen every one of them at least twice, and I won't mind seeing them some more. I think it's a kind of an experience we should share together. And what I said about the natural mind, that I have been listening, this Dave Hunt, I hope now we can reach him personally. I think we are on the track of, there's nothing he says that I can say I disagree with him. But there are many things he doesn't say, see? But there's nothing he says that I disagree with. That's a man using his mind well. He has not accepted the full revelations of God. I mean, he goes by the Bible and quotes verses from the Bible and so on. But to face the powers of hell that are operative in the world today like they never have been before in all history, with nothing but the elbow, the Bible under your elbow and your own, you know, with no respect for the whole judgment of the Christian billions of people who lived before you, with no respect for the authority of the Pope, the authority of the councils, no respect for no sense of tradition, no knowledge and so on. And then without the sacraments, he's trying to face the devil without the strength that's given to us by the sacraments, by the Mass. Now, that's where the fallacy is. But as far as answering these the occult things that are happening, I can't see anything he says that's wrong. Can you see anything, Father?
No, I just mean my brother. With your course on psychology and so on, you know, it's like the whole thing.
Now, that's what we say about the natural virtue. It is It is good as far as it goes. It's an excellent preparation for the supernatural, but it's not sufficient. It's necessary, but not sufficient. To say it's sufficient is Pelagianism. To say that a man, by trust, using his mind well and doing what's right according to his own natural reason and so on, with nothing of the order of grace, the sacraments, the faith, the supernatural, so on. That's Pelagianism. But it's necessary. I mean, if you are preaching the gospel, you get along better with a person who is naturally honest, who doesn't lie, who is not living an impure life, than with a person that is a scoundrel. But it doesn't mean that those natural virtues will take him to heaven. St. Thomas says the very first step towards heaven is an act of faith. And the act of faith has to be a supernatural act of faith. Not a brilliant judgment of the intellect.
Not a question of mine. Pelagianism and masonry. Is masonry basically Pelagianism? I never thought of that.
Yeah, that's it. Because what masonry is a war on the supernatural. And this is claiming that the natural is, except that masonry degenerates into the preternatural, the diabolic. I mean, it doesn't. I am talking about an admirable person. I wouldn't call a mason an admirable person that has done everything right. You know, he's never told a lie. He doesn't steal. He has never committed acts of impurity. So on. You say, well, then he will certainly go to heaven. No, he doesn't. Our faith says he doesn't. He won't be punished for any of the sins that he didn't commit, but he doesn't go to heaven. That's where the supernatural comes. Now, some night, very soon, I'm going to read you the article, Nature and Grace, that Father asked me to write for the house stamps in the early, in the very early days. And Father thought it was the best thing I ever wrote. I was tempted to do it tonight, but I think we better plunge into the course first, then before we can appreciate those distinctions. Nature and grace, how do they relate? I give it in one simple sentence. Natural philosophy will give us an ethics that will tell us how to be perfect men. Now, it doesn't give us the strength to become perfect men, see, because just purely it gives us the norm, the ideal, but it could never make us sons of God. No philosopher could have ever said that man was made to become a child of God. No philosopher, he would have thought it sheer absurdity. And if we didn't know the way that God arranged it to become so, through his own son and our union with him and so on, it is an absurdity. How could a man become a son of God? How could he become a participant of divine nature? It's almost blasphemy. And it is blasphemy if you take it apart from the way it is achieved for us by Jesus. And
that's the thesis of the Pope's first book on ethics, by Max Scheler. And that title was, Can We Build a Christian Ethic on the Phenomenology of Max Scheler, and he treats of that very question. I have not read the book. I've only read reviews of it. I'd love to get a hold of the book and see how he handles that. But it would be very apropos to. And the reviews say he said almost what you said, that Max Scheler gave a very lovely, natural explanation of ethics and of how man should live. But it never can be the basis of the Christian ethic, because we have another added data that God has given us from revelation through faith that has to be part of our system of ethics. I read the book, but it's very interesting to get a hold of it. I think it's appeared in English now.
When you read, I wanted us to share together reading from Aristotle. I mean, in the Middle Ages, in the ages of faith, he was called the philosopher. You feel a tremendous sympathy to this pagan, living in the darkness of paganism and groping to the light. And then you think of what fools the people who live in the age of the Christian revelation, and they don't even achieve as much light in their minds as this pagan did. I mean, they fall so far short of the truths that he had discovered as a pagan. I mean, that's something to think about, isn't it? I mean, what did Aristotle have to go on compared to what we have? Well, we started a little late tonight, but we thank God that we had the Mass. I would have loved to have gone to Father Mass there, but I was afraid that people would be coming here, so I went to Father Epaphras Mass. But still, this is a very great day in our life. Those titles of Our Lady were on this day as Queen of Martyrs and Queen of the Eucharist. And she chose it to be her first apparition at Fatima by way of confirming the values of the other two titles. So, for this glorious day that means so much to us, I am glad we have our Father to give us a blessing at the end of the class.
Patrice,